Professor Neustadt, you've been speaking of the increasing need felt by presidents to grasp control over information and sources of information in making decisions where their key constitutional responsibilities are involved. But isn't the same need for immediate control felt where the question is one of carrying out critical decisions once they've been made?
Once a president's made a judgment, particularly in diplomatic and military areas, his need is very great to try to exercise tight control over execution. One found with Mr. Kennedy that from his misadventure with the Bay of Pigs in 1961, of the Cuban exile invasion, Mr. Kennedy saw that a decision on his part resulted in 1,200 Cuban exiles going to jail in Castro's jails. Now, 1,200 men in jail as a result of a decision is not a very great thing as presidential decisions go. But I think it's fair to say that this brought home to Mr. Kennedy, vividly, the consequences of not having tight control over the execution of one's own decisions, and also the consequences of not having tight control in advance of decision over the information relevant to judgment. One cannot understand Mr. Kennedy's handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis a year and a half later without understanding how many lessons he drew from the Bay of Pigs, both on the score of getting control of information in advance and on the score of tightly controlling the execution of one's judgments once made. In October 1962, once the government had indisputable evidence that the Soviets were installing offensive missiles on Cuban territory, then the president himself took charge of the question of what kind of response the government should make. He took charge by assembling around him the chief responsible officers of the government and adding to them certain other officers in whom he personally had confidence and holding them together as a group while they thrashed out the information, the options, the possible consequences of various courses of action. And he did not take his decision until this group of advisors had been forced to look very deeply into the issues posed by their advice, the possible consequences of advice. Then he made his decision on the initial form of response that this government should take, the quarantine. Having made that decision, he proceeded during the week that the quarantine was in effect, or the 4 days that it was in effect, to maintain the tightest sort of control over its actual conduct. The ships at sea were in direct communication with Washington, and not only with Washington, but with the White House. Every move of every ship commander as merchantmen approached was audited at the White House. This is the tightest sort of control one can imagine. This is a form of control that is completely at variance with our whole military tradition. Ever since the Civil War, it has been our tradition to give the tactical commander in the field a maximum of autonomy. What Mr. Kennedy did in October 62 was remove that autonomy and keep the control at the center. I think this is very symptomatic of what will happen from here on out.
And you think this is more a function of the times than of the man and of his personality, the man who sits in the White House?
I think so. One cannot, of course, be sure. I think that the impulse to clutch, the need to clutch, the perception of the risks of not clutching will affect any intelligent man who sits there. I think you would find, if you went into the operation of the Lebanon landings in 1958, that Mr. Eisenhower, even though this was a less immediate situation in the sense of involving the Soviets, Mr. Eisenhower kept pretty close control over that one. Not as close as Mr. Kennedy in 62, but closer than would have been usual some years before. I think the situation, not the man, is the controlling element here. But of course, one can't be sure until one sees the evidence as presidents come along from year to year.
You talk about presidential need to clutch. And I wonder whether this wasn't just as true, let's say, of Lincoln. Again, a crisis president, a wartime president. The need to know what was going on because major policy decisions could be made only in terms not of a final staff document, but of a sense for all the bits and pieces.
Lincoln is a very modern president in these terms. In the pre-nuclear world, Lincoln can be called the first 20th century president. In that sense, the Civil War did not belong in the 19th century, as most contemporary observers found it hard to comprehend. It just was out of its time. The government was much bigger than it had ever been. Warfare on this scale was absolutely unknown. The problems of communication and control were more nearly like those that Roosevelt experienced in the Second World War than like anything known to any other war in the 19th century. So Lincoln, in a way, is a 20th century president. And certainly in his time, he faced the same problems of needing to get hold of information for his own judgments, and then needing to try to keep control over the execution of his judgments that a Kennedy faced. There is, however, one great difference. Mr. Lincoln was dealing most of all with critical decisions in the military sphere and in the sphere of high policy relating to the conduct of the war and of diplomacy. At the pace of military operations in those days, and given the scale of Union resources, Mr. Lincoln had opportunities to make mistakes and then do over again. This is the possibility which tends to disappear when one deals with military force on such a scale in contemporary circumstances. This is a very new thing. It only began to affect Mr. Eisenhower's presidency toward the end and affected Mr. Kennedy's and will, I have no doubt, affect Mr. Johnson's. Here we have a situation in which where there is risk of hostilities with the other possessor of major nuclear forces. There is risk not only of an irreversible development, but one which has irreparable consequences. This has begun to be true ever since the Soviet decision makers on their side have had delivery systems capable of inflicting major damage on us. But in this sense, the clutch for information and control can be a more desperate clutch in these times than even for a Lincoln, because the consequences of failing to exert control, failing to get appropriate information, can be immeasurably more severe.
Yet I know, Professor Neustadt, that many times in private industry and even indeed in government at other levels, one's picture of the unhappy, unfortunate administrator is that of the man who tries to clutch to him all bits and pieces of knowledge, the man who tries to maintain in his own office authority over whatever goes on within his organization. What you're saying now is that in our own time, the president must do this.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. And it will have many unfortunate consequences.
Of what kind?
Of the kind classically attributed to the administrator in private industry who doesn't delegate enough, tries to do too much himself. But the administrator in private industry, to the degree I understand his situation, has some greater easement than a president does. The president cannot expect that the members of the executive establishment or the members of Congress, to say nothing of private organizations outside of government on whom he may depend to do something or not do something, he cannot expect that any of these is going to exercise delegated power the way he would like to see it done, because none of these people are in his position. None of them were elected by his electorate. None of them stay in office precisely as he does. None of them bear his personal responsibility. And while every president must delegate vastly, any modern president is likely to try to clutch to himself the decisions and the control of operations in areas where his key constitutional responsibilities are involved, diplomacy and defense.
And if I understand correctly from what you've said before, you feel that the bits and pieces of information relating to these decisions must be at the president's disposal, too, which widens or broadens the need for involvement on his part in almost everything.
I'm afraid that this is so. At least I see it so. It is not the image of the clean desk administrator. Yet there are many things in political government which one cannot entrust to subordinates with any assurance that they will be done the way one would do them. It's interesting that early in Mr. Johnson's term, when he saw as his first priority an assertion of effective relations with Congress, which would get through Congress the two major leftover measures of the Kennedy administration, the ones which were symbolic of success or failure for the president in 1964. That Mr. Johnson started office attempting to do from the White House what he had done as majority leader, attempting to control the day-to-day tactics of legislative behavior from the White House, day-to-day, and got himself deeply involved, an involvement, I dare say, deeper than it would have been reasonable to expect Mr. Johnson to maintain for very long, as the need arose to involve himself deeply in foreign operations. But one can understand why Mr. Johnson would cut through the use of subordinates and reliance on his senatorial and congressional leadership and try to do himself what he felt was of absolute priority importance to his establishment of his own effective reputation as president. He had to take these things on himself directly, just as Mr. Kennedy had to take on himself directly a great deal of the work of a Secretary of State, a Secretary of Defense. The critical problem here is not that a president keep a clean desk, or not that he delegate to others and simply sit in ultimate judgment in an ivory tower. The White House is not an ivory tower. The critical problem here is that he guess right about the things to delegate, that he not take onto himself things which it turns out he didn't have to, but that he do take onto himself the things which turn out to be critical. And of course, the guessing game on what you can afford to be inattentive about, the guessing game on what you can leave aside, is a very dangerous and chancy game. It's the hardest part of a president's problem.
I gather you feel very strongly that the president at mid-century and beyond is a very, very different man from his constitutional and traditional ancestors in office.
Let me be very careful in answering this question. The contemporary president is in a very different operating situation than were most of his predecessors. Pre-Roosevelt, with the partial exception of Wilson and of Lincoln, the situation is enormously different, the operating situation. But the contemporary president who has to face this curious, complex set of operating problems I've talked about, this president stands on a foundation of authority. And that base was built by the accretion of precedent under our earlier presidents. And every president now owes something to George Washington's assertion of the dignity of the office. What Washington did as the first president with no precedents, what Washington did most of all was to occupy the office as our first genuine national hero. And ever after, even though the office fell into desuetude from time to time, it was the place which General Washington had occupied. That helps to set its status as a primary political institution. Every president owes a great deal to Andrew Jackson's assertion of the independent electoral position of the office. What Andrew Jackson did was to get himself nominated by a party convention, free of Congress. Oh, and then couple his nomination with election of electors by popular vote in the states, electors pledged in advance to vote for him. In his time, the Electoral College was transformed from a council of notables, a council of elders, to a body representative of popular votes. And at the same time, the nominating process, which brought a man within sight of those votes, was transformed from a congressional caucus to a convention of local political organizations spread throughout the country. So that Andrew Jackson added to the dignity of the office for which Washington set a precedent. His term and what happened in his term of office provided the presidency with independent national election and status as a national elective office with a stronger claim to represent the country as a whole than Congress. It's an enormous addition to presidential authority and therefore power. What Lincoln did was to invent the war power, to claim that the combination of his oath of office to preserve and defend the Constitution with the constitutional authority to act as commander-in-chief, that these things in combination gave him a semi-dictatorial authority drawn from the Constitution in time of war. And this has been enormously useful to the development of the office under Wilson and under Franklin Roosevelt. What Teddy Roosevelt did was establish the office as the most interesting source of news and entertainment in the country. Well, the first Roosevelt's administration coincided more or less the maturation of a national network of news. And through this early medium of mass communication, there came the voice, postures, ideas, antics of a very interesting man in the White House. The White House was established ever after as one of the most interesting sources of news, not only in the government, but in the country as a whole. News and entertainment in those days, there was nothing much to compete with except circuses. Wilson and the second Roosevelt, as war leaders, certainly added a great deal on which modern presidents, later presidents, built. And Roosevelt, as the leader of his country in the Great Depression, initiated a transformation of the government, of its involvement in national life, its responsibilities in economic and social welfare areas, that has made the president a personification of economy and society and concern, therefore, to a degree unknown previously. So that any contemporary president starts out with the accretion of common law added to bare constitutional provisions. Any president starts out with authority and a status in the country that rests quite as much on what his predecessors have done as on what the Constitution, with its careful ambiguities, provided.
How would you carry on the listing of the contributions made by more recent presidents?
Roosevelt's first successor, Harry Truman, did at least two things that added something to the presidency of his successors. He presided very actively over the full entry of the United States in peacetime into world responsibilities and world affairs, and was the first man who had to exercise, in modern times, the authority of this government, which constitutionally is supposed to have been shared between President and Congress, the authority to make war. Mr. Truman took us in to our third most costly war in terms of lives, without a declaration of war, without sanction of Congress. In doing so, he merely demonstrated what we now have had to accept, that technology has modified the Constitution in this respect, that decisions on the use of force abroad have got to be taken by the President and cannot be shared by Congress because of the nature of weapons, because of secrecy, complexity, and time. Mr. Truman set that precedent.
I know that you referred to the Korean War in 1950, but do you feel that this is a precedent that quite literally has been set and accepted by the American people?
Well, it quite literally has been set. It was followed in Lebanon. It was followed, at least with the authorization of alien forces, or rather special case, in 1961 in the Bay of Pigs. And I have no doubt there will be other instances. It has been accepted, I think there's no doubt of this, in Congress. Whether it's as yet fully realized throughout the country, I don't know. But at the time of the missile confrontation with the Soviets over Cuba in October 1962, I noticed no editorial comment or comment on the streets or anything of the sort suggesting any lack of recognition for the fact that decisions of these sorts are now in the hands of the president. Truman's precedent with Korea helped accustom us to what is, I'm afraid, an unfortunate and inescapable necessity. Furthermore, Mr. Truman, by presiding over, launching us into our post-war foreign policy, and sticking to his guns, sticking very firmly to decisions he had once taken, in terms of European recovery, the enunciation of the Truman Doctrine and its implementation, a whole series of decisions that were precedent-making in foreign affairs. Mr. Truman built a base of foreign policy, which has remained, in most respects, central to the character of our policy in all the periods since. These were Truman's additions.
It's strange that a man whose experiences, before he entered the presidency, were limited generally to really, in a sense, to local and state politics, should have been a man who set the kinds of precedents that you describe now.
It is strange superficially. Not only had Mr. Truman's experience been confined to local politics and to the Senate, but he alone among our recent presidents had never had any ambition for the presidency, had never fixed his eye on it, never expected or wanted to be there. The explanation, I think, is a matter of character. Character and ideas the man carried in his own head about the office. He was a great reader of American history, particularly of the lives of great men in American history. He was a young worshiper of Woodrow Wilson. He deeply respected Franklin Roosevelt, even though he and Roosevelt were at times political enemies. Roosevelt tried to purge him from the Senate in the primaries in 1940. Still, he had an enormous respect, Mr. Truman did, for the office of president, a great sense that it was the key central point of judgment and initiative in our system, and a great respect for presidents who had used it in that fashion. And when he took the office, his ideas about what was required of an incumbent there gave him something he tried very hard to live up to. He spent his time in the presidency living up to his image, his vision of what the presidency required of a man. This made it possible for him, this combined with a lot of common sense, to face complex issues resolutely, to decide them without undue worry or hand-wringing, and to stick by his decisions, because in his view of the presidency, decision and stick-to-itiveness were of the essence, and he was living up to the job as he saw it.
It is strange, though, that he should have made such an impact upon foreign policy, too.
Well, he didn't do this for no reason at all. He once said to me that Joe Stalin made our foreign policy, his foreign policy, that is, Truman's, after the war. That without Stalin, we never would have got the Marshall Plan through Congress or undertaken what has since come to be known as a containment policy. I think this is right. What Truman did was respond to very sharp challenges which arose for the United States and the world. He responded sharply and decisively to blunt pressure placed upon us in our world situation. And the blunter the pressure, not only the more decisive Mr. Truman's response, but the more assured his support from Congress. Now, it's one of the difficulties of Mr. Eisenhower in his later years, and Mr. Kennedy, and no doubt Mr. Johnson in his time, that the challenges are less sharp, less clear, they're more ambiguous, more subtle than they were in the later 1940s.
How did this affect the course of the Eisenhower administration?
The answer is that Mr. Eisenhower, in his second term, the end of his first term and his second term, found himself unable to steer a sharp, simple course of action with respect to any area of the world. If you recall, he had come into office, pledged to liquidate the Korean War. Well, the Korean War was ended. His party was pledged to roll back the Iron Curtain, pledged to an active policy of freeing Eastern Europe from communist control. Yet, when there was a revolt in East Germany in 53, when later there was the Hungarian Revolt of 56, Mr. Eisenhower's administration found itself in no position to take a sharp, concrete, simple action of the sort that Mr. Truman had undertaken with respect to Greece in 1947. There were too many risks of relationships in other parts of the world, too much uncertainty about Soviet response and about our invulnerability to the response. Similarly, the alliance system in Europe, which was built in Truman's time with Mr. Eisenhower's participation as commander of the Allied forces, the alliance system came under great strains in Mr. Eisenhower's time as Europe recovered and as it developed interests separate from American interests. And these strains, of course, have grown progressively greater in the 1960s. Throughout the world, Mr. Eisenhower faced a variety of pressures which did not permit sharp, simple answers. But it must be said for Mr. Eisenhower that in another sense, he too added something which his successors could build. Not since Washington, perhaps, has there been in the presidency so genuine a national hero. His incumbency of the presidency has added something further to its status, and his successors profit from sitting where this genuine hero sat. Furthermore, in a negative way, Mr. Eisenhower proved something about the modern presidency. He came into office very much convinced, according to his public statements, that the president had a limited role in our government, that he shared authority with Congress, that he must not attempt to influence Congress in the exercise of its authority, that the president should exercise his authority and should translate it into power only for limited objects within a rather traditional view of the presidency's position in our political system. By the time he left office, he, in his turn, had found himself acting, intervening for legislative programs, intervening against legislative programs, acting positively in foreign affairs, intervening in election campaigns for congressmen, doing all the things that shocked traditionalists when Franklin Roosevelt did them. One of the things that Mr. Eisenhower has added to this office is to suggest definitively that the modern office can never shrink to the dimensions it held, let us say, in the time of President Taft, or even in the time of Coolidge and Hoover. That the office after Roosevelt will always remain a much bigger office than I think Mr. Eisenhower initially expected it to be when he took it. Certainly by the end of his time, he was acting in the same tradition as the tradition of Roosevelt and Truman before him, and Kennedy and Johnson after him.
Thank you very much, Professor Neustadt.
Thank you.